Hello, thanks for the introduction. Thanks for having me, and sorry for stealing your group meeting. And but I'm very excited to tell you about some work that has appeared some few weeks ago. And
sorry, can you pronounce your last name again?
My last name is Bachlechner.
Bachlechner.
Bachlechner. It's an Austrian.
Is it Irish?
It's Austrian.
Austrian. Okay.
Tyrolia. Yes, it means extreme. And Lechner means someone who rents a place by the stream. So I guess people in my family rent. But anyway.
You're trying to acknowledge love.
So this is the first time I'm talking about this. And what I have is mostly a technical result. And I think there exists an interpretation for that result in terms of essentially a landscape. But if I'd like to better understand it, because I know the topic of landscapes is sort of a very emotional one, and I have a hard time understanding what would be the conditions that you would trust an anthropic explanation for some number or for a theory, and when would you not? And I'll give some criteria that I have, and maybe afterwards we can chat about those. But let me first.
It depends on who is in the room and who is not. So
well, if you don't have an answer to that question, that's an interesting thing to say.
Okay, so before I tell you about this technical result, let me first tell you about sort of the philosophy of some of the work that I've been working on. And the idea is that string theory is a really complicated theory that we don't understand at all. There exist tiny corners of string theory at weak coupling and large volume where we kind of hope that we understand some of the ingredients. And now even those corners are massively complicated, and we don't quite understand how to build low energy effective theories in those corners. We have some hints. We know what ingredients could be there, but we don't have a complete picture. Now that's sort of sad, because if we're trying to understand what kind of particle physics content we can get from string theory, what kind of cosmology can we get from string theory, this is a very hard question to answer, because this theory we don't understand. There exists these corners that are really complicated. And so what we can do is look at really simple examples where we have a lot of symmetry that protect all of the quantities. But those are precisely the corners that are very atypical in string theory, where everything might be complicated. But now complexity might not be a horrible thing. We know of many examples where the microphysics is really complicated and we have no idea how to deal with microphysics. But in the low energy effective theory, we actually have tools to answer certain questions. Certainly not the high energy questions, but there exist low energy questions that we can answer. So one nice example is nuclear physics, where we in principle know the microphysics, it's QCD, but it's really hard when we have many ingredients to compute, for example, the low energy theory of heavy nuclei. However, we do know some of the symmetries that these low energy theories need to obey. For example, we know what quantum numbers they are, what are the symmetries that the low energy theory inherits from the UV. And let's say we're interested in the distribution of energy levels of heavy nuclei. This is really complicated to compute from QCD. But what we could do instead is just write down a Hamiltonian that has all of those symmetries. And other than those symmetries, we pick all of the numbers randomly. And it turns out, if we do that, the spectrum distribution for the differences of the energy levels actually precisely matches those of experiment, and if you compute those with a simulation in the UV. So that's one nice example, where we could just use the symmetries of the UV to learn something about the low energy physics. And crucially, that was one of the nice examples of random matrix theory, where the microphysics doesn't really matter, but all that matters is the universality in the low energy theory, which is essentially all of these numbers get scrambled up. And in the end, the probability distribution doesn't really depend on the microphysical parameters, but just on the broad symmetries that were there in the problem. And now we can hope to do the same thing with string theory. We might not know what ingredients there specifically are, and we might not understand the microphysics, But we can write down a low energy theory, which in principle is consistent with all the things that we know in the UV, and then study ensembles of those theories. So instead of writing down one specific UV theory and studying the low energy limit of that, we might learn new things by writing down all possible theories or ensembles of theories in the IR that are consistent with the UV. Look at those low energy theories and see what corners are interesting. And if we find an interesting corner, then we can go back in string theory and try to find an example of that in string theory.
And you get optical pacification.
There are people that claim that they can get it in local models.
This has been published.
Yes. Locally, there's not a global compactification where you write down a compactification, stabilize all moduli. There exist examples where you stabilize all the moduli, but it doesn't have the standard model in it. So we've done this before with studying diameters of field spaces. So if you want to, for example, you say you're interested in large field inflation. Large field inflation requires an inflaton displacement that is super Planckian. People have tried very hard by fine-tuning things in the UV to get super Planckian field displacements in an inflationary model. And well, inherent to that approach is that you need to fine-tune something. But instead, what we've done in recent work was just consider ensembles of low energy theories and compute what is generic. And it turns out, generically, one would expect that in a complicated string theory compactification, you do have a large possible field displacement. So then what we did is, instead of looking at a simple model of string theory, we looked at the one compactification which is actually known with a large number of Kähler moduli. And in that model, we do demonstrate that there exists a super Planckian field displacement, just as you would have expected in those generic low energy theories. And so obviously, we haven't been able to show that this is actually an inflationary model, but it sort of points you towards the kind of string theory models that could have interesting physics that might not lie in a simple range. So instead of talking about inflation or field ranges, today I want to talk about static things in string theory or low energy theories that could possibly arise from string theory, which is the distribution of vacua in theories that contain a large number of axions. Yes?
Which is connected to the first question. If we don't see supersymmetric particles in run two, the LHC, what does that do for string theory?
I don't think anything, because.
Anything.
Well, it means you have Susie breaking at.
Not much would be a slightly safer answer.
OK, yes. I mean, if we saw a supersymmetry, that would tell us that, OK, well.
And you could say, well, it'd be nice if.
Yes. Okay. Yes. But string theory doesn't predict.
The Susie breaking scale in string theory is not pinned down to be, yes, we should see this in the LHC too. And if we don't see it, string theory is dead. There's no safety like that.
But string theory depends on the
supersymmetry. At the string scale?
Well, in the UV, sure.
Some scale.
Or at least perturbative string theory.
That tells us that string scale is not at the TUV, yes.
We won't see for 50 years.
That's okay. That's
normal. Maybe.
Okay. Maybe we'll delay that until later. Okay. So I say we want to study theories with many axions. Why are axions interesting? Well, right now they're interesting. Well, because in all, currently all of the cosmological observations are in excellent agreement with lambda CDM cosmology, which is a really simple model. It doesn't have many parameters, and it seems to match the data very nicely. Now, in the next few years, the tensor to scalar ratio, which essentially tells us whether we have super Planckian or sub Planckian field displacements, will be constrained to an interesting range, less than 0.01, which can constrain models of large field inflation. And these models of large field inflation, where you have a large field displacement, you can only have a large field displacement if you protect your potential over a large field range, right? Typically, when you move in some potential of an effective field theory over a distance that's large compared to the cutoff of the theory, you'll have large corrections from operators that are suppressed by this, the cutoff of your theory. But once you move over the Planck scale, really there's nothing that can suppress those operators. So you need some symmetry that holds in the UV to make sure that these potentials are flat over a large distance. Now, axions are fields that exhibit an exact discrete shift symmetry in string theory. And those fields are interesting to study because they can give rise to exactly this flat potential. And many people have looked into this. And as I already said, we've demonstrated that there exists Planckian field space diameters in string theory. And today I will argue that if you write down a theory with many of those fields, generically you don't only get a large field space diameter, but also you get a vacuum structure which is rich enough to accommodate the cosmological constant. That is, you get an exponential number of possible vacua. Or in short, when Busse-Polchinski told you that you can tune all of your fluxes in order to get a large number of vacua with different cosmological constants, that's really just half of the story. There exists an exponentially large number in the complex structure moduli, but I'll argue today that there also exists an exponentially large number in the number of Kähler moduli, and I'll tell you what those words mean. But yesterday I read in an article saying that the attention span in a typical talk is like 10 minutes. So within the first, I guess I'm already over time, but I want to immediately tell you the one thing that you can take away, which is a really a simple idea, and it's not anything complicated, and that's where this exponentially large number comes from. So let me start by first telling you why do we expect an exponentially large number in theories where the fields are periodic. So let's say we have a theory with some field that is periodic under some angle. Let's say S theta goes to theta plus 1 over 5. Everything in the potential is periodic, or let's say just the leading potential is periodic. So this is one of those potential. This is the theta direction, and here we have some potential. And as the theta direction goes from theta to theta plus 1 over 5, so it is a discrete shift, the potential essentially replicates. But it might not exactly replicate, because this theta goes to theta plus 1 over 5 symmetry might not be the largest symmetry that's there in your problem. Let's say Dirac quantization only demands that theta goes to theta plus 1 is an actual symmetry of the full potential. So there could be other terms that are subleading that have a shift symmetry as theta goes to theta plus 1, which means that this entire potential is periodic over this range as theta goes to theta plus 1. But the leading potential could have a different periodicity. So there exist multiple of these essentially identical potentials inside one of the fundamental domains of the overall potential. But what does this mean? This means that if we have some subleading term which has the minimal periodicity, this subleading term will not repeat itself over those periods, which means that if we have a vacuum in the first fundamental domain, this vacuum will still be there in the next domain of the leading potential, but the vacuum energy will be slightly different because the subleading term shifts the potential energy a little bit. And then in the next domain, it's again a bit different, and again a bit different, and again a bit different. So in this simple example, instead of having just one vacuum which repeats itself, for each of these vacua of the leading potential, there actually exist 5 different vacua. And these 5 different vacua come from the fact that you have subleading terms that break the periodicity. Okay, so this isn't terribly exciting in the one-dimensional case. But now let's crank up the number of dimensions, and let's consider n dimensions. Now we have the same story. Now we have a potential which has a leading contribution. And the leading contribution is periodic as theta goes to theta plus 1 over n, little n, which is some periodicity. And then a subleading term which has the minimal periodicity that's required from the axion symmetry. Yeah, they're all coming from instanton, but I'll let you know later where they come from, and some concerns you might have, but why you don't have to worry about the concerns. Yes. So this is a very simple model. We just write it down. We have now n fields that are periodic. So theta goes to theta plus 1 over n in the leading potential. But this leading periodicity is broken by subleading terms. But now how does this field space look? Essentially, you have a hypercube of side length 1. Right? As each of the thetas goes to theta plus 1, the whole potential replicates. So you have this hypercube. Side length 1, where the whole potential is identical. But the leading potential is periodic over hypercubes of much smaller side length. The side length of the leading potential hypercube is just 1 over n, which means that in this hypercube of side length 1, there exist n to the n distinct vacua. Because periodicity of the leading potential is a different periodicity from the subleading potential. And that's how you split all of these minima that you thought would be degenerate of the leading potential. You split them into an exponential number of minima with all different energies. And what this essentially ends up with is having these bands that are not very wide, but you split all of these vacua into a ton of other vacua. And the length of this, how wide this band is essentially determined by the scale of these subleading terms.
Is that the J or the I there?
Oh, that's an I. Yeah. Well, it should be an I. Okay, so that's essentially the whole idea. That's all there is. And Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can I just ask?
Yes.
It's a very loaded question.
since you gave us the whole big idea, maybe I'll ask my one question. So there's a sense in which the level splitting has to be sufficiently dense and sufficiently uniform dense to really address the Hilbert constant problem. So are you going to talk about that?
So it's a uniform distribution because. Well, in this theory, it's not really independent. But in general, you have some charges here, some charges here. But those don't know about each other. So the splitting doesn't know anything about what the leading periodicity is, which means that the energy distribution is really uniform over that whole range.
I see. So your picture was just
this one?
Yeah.
This is pretty relatively uniform.
Yeah.
Here, well, I mean, some of them are toppers.
Sure.
But it gets more complicated in a multi-dimension case, which we'll address too. Yes?
I keep asking the basic questions. Let's get back to experimental physics. After over 3 decades, we have not detected one action. We want many.
Uh-huh.
In the present universe. There could be actions in the very early universe.
In the string theory compactifications that we understand,
we
they can be. They can be stabilized at scales much higher than.
We haven't seen them in the present.
Oh, they're there, but we haven't built the. I don't know that they're there.
No.
You could probe whether they are there if you.
No,
if you believe that they're there, then they're there.
No.
You can.
You
can build an accelerator with a high enough energy, and then you can test whether they're there. But I agree, we haven't seen them.
No.
And in fact, had we seen them, those would not be the possible axions that I'm talking about.
You want
N? Yes, N can be very, in the string theory configuration that we understand, you can make them very heavy. So they wouldn't affect our low energy physics.
That's OK, we found the Higgs, there's one scale of your
we're fine, and we'll just add a pseudo N.
So I'm a bit concerned with the signs here. It seems that all of these are positive, so you cannot get a small amount of constant. Unless you deliver the use of signs.
Well, you don't necessarily want this thing to be small, but this thing plus a different contribution, V naught, and that can be negative or positive. But you just want the spacing to be dense enough. And then, I mean, you get quantum corrections anyway. And yes. And not claiming that this is the potential of our universe.
Your J, like, the second term is like a copy of the first term, except you have n more this lambda i's, and the J still should run one to big another run.
Yeah, the indices aren't the best here. I'll write down a better. This is just a very rough picture. Hopefully we'll get to the full picture. But okay, so the plan for today is, now that I've told you all of it, first I'll motivate why is a cosmological constant interesting. Then I'll briefly discuss landscape approaches to the cosmological constant problem. And maybe you can tell me when would that approach be reasonable. Then I'll discuss essentially this philosophy of sampling over an ensemble of theories, and we look at what the vacuum distribution is in these random axiom theories. This will have implications for the scale of Susie breaking in the landscape, and those are generic implications. I'll give you an example of an explicit string theory compactification where exactly this phenomenon happens. And then I'll conclude. So let's start with the CC problem. I guess most of you are familiar with it, but essentially the idea is that Einstein's equation couples vacuum energy to the curvature of space-time. Now, in the standard model, we sort of understand quantum fluctuations very well at low energies, and we can compute what contribution does the standard model give to the vacuum energy of space-time, and the contribution is like 10 to the minus 60 in Planck units. Okay, that's a nice prediction, but unfortunately, when you look at this Einstein equation, it also tells us about how big is the observable universe. And it turns out that if the vacuum energy really is as large as all of these contributions from the standard model, our observable universe would be not too big, to the point where at some point we couldn't see our feet anymore because we just don't fit in a universe. It seems difficult to be living in there. And the time scale at which, so the size of the universe and the time scale at which the vacuum energy will dominate is given by this this 1 over the square root of the cosmological constant. Now, if we don't just have a vacuum energy, but we also have matter in our universe, one could make the argument that in order to live inside of a galaxy, the time scale at which the cosmological constant becomes dominant should have something to do with the time scale at which galaxies are important, because that gives you an interesting interplay at which one might expect life to occur. So this was a prediction, I guess, of Weinberg a long time ago, saying that if the CC has been anthropically selected, we should see a CC, a cosmological constant, that is roughly similar to the timescale of galaxy formation. And that would predict that you have this enormous cancellation. I didn't really say why you have this enormous cancellation. But okay, that would be a prediction of an anthropic sort.
This word many. So you don't want to include me.
So are you talking about
in the bottom?
In the bottom? Yeah. Okay, so
you don't accept the planetary orbit is not determined by something?
Okay, so first, why it seems like putting us into
I would disagree with a lot of what you said earlier, but you're just echoing things I want you to make point. Okay, I would say almost everyone except that's for planetary orbits.
Almost everyone, but then I googled it, and there are actually some religious groups that.
Well, yes. that's something you can fill in anything you like after the words you just said.
No. Okay. Well, not for all, anyway. Maybe we shouldn't go there. But okay, so there exist parameters in physics that many of us accept to be anthropically selected. Now, why do most of us accept this for planets? Well, we look in the sky and we see planets at all kind of orbits. In principle, there's no reason that they shouldn't all be populated. And we have a way of counting them. So we know they exist. We know how to count them. And in principle, there's no reason that they couldn't all be populated. And then we can do a thought experiment. Let's say we build our universe and we put planets all over the place, and then we send a seed for life on all of them and wait a long time, and then we send a survey around and ask, what orbits do you live on? And most of the beings would say, well, in the habitable zone. So it seems like that's sort of something that makes sense for planets. It's not quite clear what the requirements are for this to make sense in the multi.
Tautology. Because we see things.
Okay.
So it depends on we don't want to get into philosophical.
Well, I guess, yeah, I had a very hard time writing this introduction because this is. I can do a technical calculation, but then I don't know what it
is. I guess the technical question is, but where did that long number come from? What was that?
It's not the precise number.
What was that number?
It's a random number that I want to illustrate that you need.
Like, how many zeros are there?
60. Well, there's 60 zeros, 60 non-zero, and you need this cancellation.
Okay.
I counted that, but it's those are not the precise numbers in our universe. But it's just an illustration. Okay, now we live in a world where luckily we have experimentalists who go measure things, and they've measured the cosmological constant in multiple ways after Weinberg made his argument. And it turns out that the cosmological constant is really of the same scale as the time scale at which galaxies dominate. So this is sort of interesting, and it also means an incredible success of a very simple cosmological model. And so it looks like the CC might have something to do with galaxies, and our current physics works. So to get on, what are the requirements that we want to impose on a theory of the multiverse that we could then be happy with and say it's anthropics? Of course, it's interesting to consider other possibilities, because we always should do that. And even in an anthropic universe, you don't just have a number that you can scan, but if you scan over different theories, and there exists another theory which makes the CC look precisely the same way, you'll even anthropically select that one. But what are the requirements that we want to pose at a theory so we can accept this anthropic reasoning? And I think there are at least three requirements. One is that this theory exists and is consistent with quantum gravity. Then we have a way of counting different universes. And I would call those both part of the theory. Then we need to demonstrate that in this theory, there exists a vacuum structure which has a large number of universes in the habitable zone. And those vacua allow for a consistent cosmology. Now, if I present you a theory that satisfies all of these three points in a convincing way, would you be happy?
No.
Yes.
Okay. Maybe.
All of these are necessary conditions.
Okay.
There's a lot of details in what exactly you mean by something that's worth it. Okay,
fine. Okay, maybe we can talk.
I mean, there's a sufficiency a necessity problem that is, I don't know how to get around. I mean, how do you know for any anthropic argument that, next week somebody won't come up with a non-anthropic explanation?
That's great. Then you
still. Yeah. I don't know if anthropics can ever be more than.
It's always going to be part of the story. The selection effects will always be part of the story. That's completely not controversial. If you believe the thing about the planets, that you believe in selection effects.
Yeah.
I guess it's a sociological.
No, there is a selection effect if there is a selection.
Yes.
If there is no selection,
then it's not.
Yeah. You're an observer, aren't you?
No, but if there is just one cosmological constant, then how can you select one?
Yeah.
There is premise that there are lots of choices.
So if you have lots of choices, then selection is transported. Yes, we can all agree on that. The question is, how do you know?
I'm not asking for anyone to.
Do you claim to have an answer to this? If you don't, it's fine. I don't.
No, I don't. That's why I'm asking. But I think it's also partially a sociological question. Obviously, there's no way to actually show that this is the answer. Yes, there could be some other mechanism. But the question is, what would satisfy you to the point? Like, I assume lots of people believe that planets are selected for by we can live there.
It's usually an explanation of last resort. That is, I've given up on finding anything else, so this is all accepted.
So right before you die,
you'll
say, yes,
so if
I don't have to play that large an evaluation of myself.
But that's what that's like saying, what is the unified theory of everything? Does it exist? I don't know. You just keep trying things until, you know.
Well, sometimes the answer is clearly yes. Does it exist? Whether we will ever find it or whether we're starting to, they're individually as a species.
Anyway,
okay.
Before
we finish this, it took 50 years to solve the problem of superconductivity, low temperature superconductivity. During that time, no one played the multiverse card. No one, 50 years.
Is there strong anthropic pressure towards?
We haven't been at this problem yet for 50 years.
Okay.
I think there is a solution. There's always a solution to the problem. This is giving up.
I disagree.
Okay, good. Maybe now that we've...
There's a very strong opinion.
I'm very happy to discuss this, but maybe we'll do that after the technical points. And okay, so obvious question to ask. If we just write down a theory, nothing else, just axions that we already showed that can give you inflation, it's interesting. And because it can also give you a nice vacuum structure, which could, in principle, populate the landscape. So there are also other approaches. I guess we've already discussed enough. That let's just continue. And before proceeding, let's briefly review a short history of the landscape, where it came about. And I think it starts a very long time ago with Brown and Teitelbaum, where they suggested that if we have a universe where we have a four-form field strength that permeates everything, four-form field strength couples to membranes. And so if we tune the parameters in that theory very precisely, then we can have a vacuum structure like so, where you have some amount of flux in your universe, and every time you nucleate a membrane, one unit of flux is discharged, and that lowers the vacuum energy by a very small amount. And that means the vacuum distribution looks like this washboard Abbot-type potential. Now, it's nice in the way that you get a large number of vacuum. On the other hand, you have precisely the same fine-tuning you had before. So you need to fine-tune your flux charges to be small. And also, it does not give you a universe which is actually consistent with ours. Because as you go from the second to last vacuum to the last vacuum, how much energy do you release? You release exactly as much energy as you will have in the vacuum energy of the last vacuum. And that is not enough to drive inflation and populate our universe. Now, in 2000, very nicely, Busso and Polchinski said, well, let's try to do this with multiple fluxes. We know in string theory, at least in corners, there are multiple fluxes which can contribute. And let's see what happens in that case. So let's briefly look at that. We know that each of these fluxes that are wrapped on some cycle, let's say you have some number of cycles, you can put fluxes on those cycles. Every time you put a flux on a cycle, you can only put an integer number because of the boundary condition of fluxes on these cycles. But every time you add a flux, you also add some charge in your manifold. But because it's a compact space, you cannot add an arbitrary number of these fluxes. So you have some constraint that you cannot add more than, say, 10 fluxes. And then you can count how many possible configurations of these fluxes are there. When you have, say, 500 of those cycles that you can put fluxes on, you allow yourself to put a total of 10 fluxes. How many possible configurations can you have? It's a high-dimensional problem, and you have a vast number of possible configurations. You have 10 to the 500 different possible configurations. And each of these configurations has a vacuum energy, which can, in principle, be distinct, because all of these configurations are different from each other. So they'll, in general, have a different contribution to the vacuum energy.
Just make a quick objection. I'm going to confuse you and not be okay. Lunch. I would maintain this story just does not work.
OK, well, that's fine. This is just.
This is not the story, I guess.
No, you're quoting somebody else. Well, just real quick. So if you put a flux on a subcycle in a manifold, just by Gauss's law, you have a source somewhere you need to sink.
Mm-hmm.
Source it, positive and negative attract, or in other words, these configurations with flux have a higher energy than the configurations without flux. positive entry theorem.
Do you have map maps, or you don't have to absorb it?
If
you have
if it's on a subcycle, if it's proportional with the volume you're saying, then if it's on a subcycle, you're dead.
But you don't have to have sources.
If it's proportional with the volume, that's a different story. But if it's on a subcycle, as in the case here, in the string theory case, at least that everything I've ever seen, you take a 60 micromanifold and you put the flux on 2 and 3 cycles. 2 and 3 series, you can't get smaller than 2 cycles. So these things would normally attract and collapse the thing in, at least in convective cases.
You say it's unstable.
So the only way I know to get a so there's a repulsion is to introduce negative energy states, or antipoles being
individual
ones. And furthermore, if you want these things to be a logical between, I need to be able to dynamical choices. Now you've got a dynamical negative energy source. And then, unless you can prove to me otherwise, your theory is nonsense. It's unbound from below. And I'm particularly willing to claim, and this is my little contribution to this, that you can show that the orientables, you can distort into more negative energy cousins. Essentially, it's pretty clear, orbital negative energy. So that's the brief.
I don't have anything to add to that, that discussion right now. I'll also unfortunately need orientables, but just to get, anyway. To get the sitter, you need some source of negative tension.
Is there a consensus that this picture doesn't work for that, or yet?
I don't know that I could argue there's a consensus. The most I can say is I haven't found anyone who's had any kind of counter argument
for like this. There's a Rubin
source. Yeah, those are proportional to the fluxes is proportional to the volume. That's a different story, like we're saying.
Right, so why couldn't we just stick to those guys?
They're not sufficient for the present. No one knows how to get anything remotely realistic with a front group technically. The manifolds that people are normally talking about have lots of moduli, lots of semi directions, and adding fluxes like this are the only way anybody knows how to stabilize something.
Okay, maybe let's continue over lunch and anyway, you
can reel the whole talk, but I need to do it.
Okay. So we have this term here, which can give like an arbitrary finely tuned number, but it's some positive number. But then you can have some other contribution coming from the underlying supersymmetry of your theory, and that can be negative. And so in the end, you can end up with zero CC. But you have these many possible solutions. And then, obviously, the question is whether those are stable, whether you can actually have orientable fold in string theory. Those are interesting questions that I don't make any progress on today. But there was another. So this is sort of the known story. Everyone's like, oh, string landscape, and now let's go. But there was another proposal a few years later by Banks, Stein, and Seiberg, which is the story of irrational axions. So the idea is that you have one axion with a discrete shift symmetry, and then the potential for this axion is generated by two non-perturbative terms, which means that the first term has some periodicity, and the next term has another periodicity, which we say is irrational. And if the periodicity of those two terms has a relative ratio which is irrational, that means this potential never repeats. But this also means that if you have some vacua, those vacua will have solutions at an arbitrary energy. Now, this again is nice because you get your theory of many vacua, but again, you cannot implement it in a consistent quantum gravity theory because you cannot get irrational decay constant. And also, it again leads to this empty universe problem. And now, the obvious thing to do today is we also have multiple axions in string theory. So let's see what happens there. And now that's what I want to study. So now we'll study the vacuum distribution in some theory with multiple axions that's actually motivated from string theory and doesn't have any irrational decay constant or any fine tuning in it. So the theory that we'll consider is Lagrangian of this type. We have some metric on moduli space and some axions, theta, and the first term is a kinetic term. And then we have a potential. So these axions are fields that have tall orders in perturbation theory are protected by a continuous shift symmetry. This continuous shift symmetry is broken only by non-perturbative effects. So each of these terms corresponds to a non-perturbative effect. But because you cannot have these non-perturbative effects, you need to have proper boundary conditions. They will only give rise to terms that still preserve a discrete shift symmetry, which means that everything that can appear is essentially some periodic function in terms of the argument. And the argument is some integer multiplied with our axions, such that each of these terms is invariant under theta goes to theta plus 1. And we choose our units such that this is the basic periodicity. So the quantities that appear is this integer matrix, which tells us what kind of combinations appear inside the cosines. Then there exists some scales, the scales of the instantons. And then there can be some other contribution to the vacuum energy from sector, which has nothing to do with the axions.
Is Kij different from other matter fields? Symmetric matrix.
It's just the effective matter.
Effective matrix.
Yeah,
for the axions.
For these axions.
Yeah.
Which I would say, for reasons that they can't fit.
Yeah, yeah. we need some negative tension. But if you believe in stabilization and 2B, then.
Well, within this framework.
Yes, in this framework,
I will believe in stabilization in some other framework which has not been worked out.
Write down a 40 EFT with these fields.
Assuming
that's what we're doing for today.
You're assuming the second thing exists, and then
you're proceeding from there. Right. Yeah. OK. Now let's split this potential up into two parts. One is the leading contribution, the strongest axions. And those have some charge matrix curlicue. And then there exists the remaining part, which for all purposes really doesn't matter for the potential. Shape of the potential is identical, because those are really subleading contributions. And they have some other charges, q remaining. And they're all integers.
Could you give me an idea about what in the structure of the fundamental theory controls this hierarchy of scales?
The hierarchy of scales comes from the fact, well, they're coming from instantons. Instantons generically contribute with e to the 1 over some coupling constant. So if you imagine that those coupling constants have some distribution coming from a specific geometry, then you would expect to have one dominant one.
This has the exponential level of our coupling constant, the lambda?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the D-brain instanton would be e to the minus the action of those instantons.
Right.
Now, if you have a volume of this size and a volume of that size, the volume of that size is essentially negligible because it's e to the minus the volume. The action is proportional to the volume.
There are two. Well, I'm just curious if you have to come up. So one is that, of course, in every semi-realistic thing I've heard of, G isn't all that small. Essentially, because the line structure constant is all that small. So there's a question about how much is this expression. And two is, how do you know these are the only non-perturbative effects? Because in some sense, you're claiming that I understand non-perturbative strength.
No, yeah, right. So you do understand some parts of the non-perturbative effect. There exist
right.
known unknowns that you don't know what they are.
Right.
That's the whole point. But
okay.
They're unknown for me. So let's say one day maybe you know them. It's not inconceivable that these axions still remain there. I mean, it still contributes some part to the axion potential. They cannot break the shift symmetry to all orders in G-string and alpha prime.
Well, that's a slight tautology. If they did, then there wouldn't be the shift symmetry.
The shift symmetry remains unbroken to all orders in G-string.
Well, if there was a non-perturbative effect which did not allow the shift symmetry, then the shift symmetry would
yes, but those,
not be there.
Those have been shown by Wen and Witten to not exist.
I'm sorry?
But Wen and Witten have shown that to all orders in G-string and alpha prime, they...
So the derivative statement is fine.
Yes.
That we're not...
They're
certainly not infinitesimally small.
OK, maybe we should... Okay. Maybe we should.
Okay.
Let's just.
I have no comments to an acceptable answer as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. So I was warned to not ever go over time, so I will not. But now let's go fast. So the leading potential is essentially all that dominates where our vacua are, and the subleading part doesn't really matter for where their vacua are. So let's write the leading potential in terms of some field where we can make manifest where these vacua are. It means we define a field phi, which is essentially just the argument of these cosines, such that each of the vacua are essentially at the points like 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and then 1, 0, 0, 0, and so on, such that the vacua are located on the integer lattice. Right, so now vacua are located on the integer lattice. And because the height of the vacua is set by the dominant potential, this height is set essentially by the scale of the leading non-perturbative effects, which means there is some wide range of vacua of energies where these vacua are distributed among. Okay, now let's see what happens with the subdominant part. Let's plug our field phi, which tells us where these vacua are, into the subdominant potential. Now this looks like that, and we can write down what the shift symmetry is, assuming of the subleading potential, assuming that in the subleading potential, essentially all charges are allowed. Everything that's allowed by direct quantization is going to be in the subleading potential. And I think that makes sense because you have an infinite number of possible instantons, and all possible instantons will contribute. It might not be dominant, but they will certainly be there. That's the whole definition of this. So the periodicity of the subleading potential is given by this equation. It means that the subleading potential is now in different coordinates periodic on the unit lattice. But this n without the prime tells us where the vacua of the dominant vacuum potential is. But there is an 1 over the charges appearing. So this was the 1 over 5 in our entry example. So this might be a little bit confusing, but let's just draw it. So this is the fundamental domain of the subleading potential. It's the unit hypercube. And if we draw the fundamental domain of this lattice generated by 1 over q, which tells us where these leading vacua are, there exists leading vacua at all of these points. So the question is, how many of these leading vacua are inside a unit hypercube? Well, it's just 1 over the volume of one of those fundamental domains of the leading potential, which is given by the determinant of the charges of the leading potential. And again, here's how this looks. So this is the periodicity of the subleading potential, and this periodicity is broken by the leading potential. Does that make sense? Okay. And now we haven't really put a measure. I just told you that the number of vacua scales as the determinant of some matrix. Now let's put a measure on these theories. That is, we specify what kind of matrices Q can be allowed. And if you say that the charges, well, what should they be? The charges of the leading instantons will be some small numbers. They're not going to be huge charges because this would correspond to higher harmonic instantons. So let's pick some zeros and ones. So the Q matrix will be some sparse matrix with some ones and zeros distributed in there. And the determinant of a matrix is actually, when you randomly distribute some ones and zeros, has a very simple probability distribution. It's distributed as the product of some chi-squared variables. And that means that you can compute what's the expected value of the number of vacua. So sigma q here is sort of the average or the standard deviation of the entries of q. And you need at least some number of entries for this q matrix to approach this universal behavior, right? When it's too simple, this q matrix will not approach this simple universal behavior. And when you have at least a fraction of 3 over n, where n is the size of this matrix, of the entries be non-vanishing, then you approach this universal behavior. And the number of vacua scales as 3 over e to the n. So in the universal behavior, the number of vacua in generic action theories with this measure is exponential. Okay, I guess this was slightly technical, but the whole point is just what you expect it to work in this simple example that I showed you at the beginning works once you put a measure on the space of charges. And then you can ask, of course, the question whether this measure has anything to do with things that we've seen from string theory. Okay, let's just consider these two problems. One was, if we go from the second to last vacuum to the last vacuum, do we release enough energy in order to populate our universe and live there? So we need to know what's the difference in vacuum energy between neighboring vacua. But we can simply estimate that by saying, well, let's say we have a leading potential, which is precisely periodic, and this periodicity is only broken by one subleading term. So you can write this subleading term like so. And now we consider a transition from a second to last vacuum to a neighboring vacuum. And we ask, by how much does this term in the potential change? Well, each of these, so this is a matrix, and when you multiply it out, it's a sum of n terms. And each of these n terms is an order one contribution. Because you have so many possible choices what this n can be, you can essentially make a very finely spaced choice of what the final vacuum energy should be. But then when you move from n, one entry goes to n plus 1, this argument changes by an order one number, which means that the amount that the potential changes is not small compared to the scale of the subleading potential, but it's just the subleading potential. So as long as the subleading contributions are larger than the reheating energy density, in the second to last to the last step, you will have enough energy to reheat the universe. And this also makes the problem of finding a vacuum energy very complex. It's an NP-hard problem. And this complexity was what really made the flux landscape very interesting. But this is precisely the same complexity that you have in this exit landscape. It's
non-polynomial. Something that's very hard to compute with any realistic
compute. NP means non-polynomial.
No,
what does she mean?
It's a very hard problem. Let's discuss afterwards. I don't want to comment on this on record.
So why are you, sorry, go ahead. Can I ask an empty universe problem in the original Brown and Oh picture? So there, I can imagine there'd be some vacua which start at some high CC and then just rapidly tunnel down just by chance, and that wouldn't happen.
Well, the idea is that each of these vacua are actually stable, and in order for our universe to survive a long time, the tunneling rate needs to be very low. Yes, there will be one instanton that takes you over many vacua,
right,
but so this is exponentially suppressed.
Right, but why does it matter that it's exponentially suppressed? So maybe most universes are empty, but as long as there's some that are not.
But it's exponentially suppressed compared to. So this would predict that our universe has.
But shouldn't we condition on it being not empty?
I don't understand anthropics, I guess. Yeah.
Something besides tunneling, then you're guaranteed by the mechanism of tunneling that you just end up with an empty open universe. You need tunneling and rolling.
Both.
You need both.
The problem is you don't have rolling, or this here you don't. Rolling. Basically just because the instanton has this O4 symmetry, so you get an open universe, like something that starts out dominated by curvature can only become not dominated by curvature if you have a subsequent Bobert inflation. So Kulchinski also has this problem?
It does, mm-hmm. But then there's like a paragraph in their paper where they talk about how after you change the flux, maybe you end up in a slightly unstable part of this big moduli space, and then you roll a little bit, and then that's all the problem.
But as some of it is an obvious thing, you need other stuff, right? I mean, universe is not just the mushroom potential of the star model. So I mean, part of that is, I guess, you have to have an inflation. I don't think it's a terribly hard requirement. It's not too bad, because yes, it's just one thing you could prevent one.
Okay, let's maybe continue briefly. And so just to show you some numbers, I guess it wasn't quite obvious that if you actually compute this product of matrices, they're all order one numbers. But let's look at an explicit example. Say the leading instanton charges are this matrix. This has a determinant of like 50, which means that you can tune your vacuum energy 0.02. Note that it scales exponential with the number of fields. So once you have instead of 20 axions, you have, let's say, 200 axions, you easily get your desired hierarchy. But if we then compute what is the subleading potential, the subleading potential, this is what appears. So as you change from a vacuum at n equals like some integers to change one of those integers plus 1, really the whole sum changes by a large amount. And
why do you care only about the neighboring vacuum?
Oh, you might not.
I mean, you could tunnel from something as far away.
But you need to tunnel an exponential distance, and there's so many more neighboring vacua.
But
that
it doesn't go as exponential at distance. There's some, isn't there like the, I guess in common version, there's some absolute denominator that has to be the difference in the vacuum. So
that's another effect which also doesn't want you to tunnel to similar energies, but to very different energies. It's a complicated problem in general. That's why I've only hinted towards this by considering tunneling to neighboring vacua. Really, you should study what's the tunneling transition as you go from one vacuum to the next one, to the next one, to the next one. It becomes difficult, but much more manageable than in a flux landscape, because here you have an explicit potential, and you know what it is. And in a flux landscape, it's slightly more difficult. OK, in the last 3 minutes, let's just briefly comment on what this means for Suzy breaking. So instead of telling you all technical things, essentially, let's say you have one flux vacuum, which is very stable. And this is a Suzy ADS vacuum, all is well. But now as you, and this in this vacuum, all of the F terms are zero. Now as you go from this vacuum to a neighboring vacuum, which is only broken by this subleading potential, this will stabilize the superpotential contribution of the subleading term, not at the minimum, which means that this will contribute a small F term Suzy breaking. But because there exists an exponential number of these other vacua, as opposed to this one vacuum where you have supersymmetry, really this tells you that an exponentially large fraction of vacua, when these axion bands exist, should have broken supersymmetry at relatively low scales, because it's only broken by the subleading potential. But then the question is, what is subleading? It could still be vastly above the TEV scale. But this tells you that you really have a new tool to study Suzy breaking in the landscape, and you might not expect to live in a Suzy vacuum, but might be exponentially more likely to live in a Suzy broken vacuum. OK, and now let's, I promised you a string compactification. So there don't exist a whole lot of string compactification where you understand the known contributions to the instanton potential, and you've stabilized all of the fluxes. But Deniff, Douglas, Florera, Grassi, and Kafru have demonstrated one, which is non-trivial, essentially just to show that KKLT can actually stabilize the Kela moduli. And they've picked a particular geometry. This geometry has 51 Kela moduli, so it's getting there. We want a large number of Kela moduli. And three complex structure moduli, so you don't have that many fluxes, but you can do some tuning. And they've computed some contributions to the non-perturbative superpotential. That has 60 terms. Because you have the whole geometry and everything is stabilized, you can also compute what is the metric moduli space. The largest metric eigenvalue is 0.1 in Planck units, which means that you don't have any superPlanckian x and decay constants. So everything is good, and the quantum corrections that are known are on the order of a percent. Now here's this Q matrix. And you can actually compute it from geometry. So it's hard to read, but there's some ones and some sixes in there. And this contributes to the non-perturbative superpotential. So first, I told you that you want to use this random matrix theory. And really, there's no reason that just by picking some Q matrices randomly, this should actually give you what the string theory result tells you as well. But in a paper with Cody Long and Liam McAllister, we've computed the random matrix theory prediction for what is the diameter of the axion field space. And that diameter is, in this example, 1.2 M Planck, and you compute the actual diameter, this compactification is precisely the same. And there we haven't used any of the microphysics that went into this model, but just used random matrix theory. So it seems like random matrix theory sort of works, at least in this example. And well, we have some sixes in the charge matrix, and all of the instanton actions are approximately the same, which means that if you choose these one-loop determinants, you do a 10% tuning on that, you find a huge number of vacua, like 10 to the 40 in this case, because you have this tuning essentially makes these instantons the leading ones. They have this charge 6 in there. So if you take 6 to the 51, you get a huge number of distinct vacua. Unfortunately, because of all of the symmetry, these vacua, a lot of them are degenerate. But you still have distinct choices of your fields that give you a huge number of vacua that you wouldn't have expected in this simple example. OK, let me just briefly conclude. By considering the Kähler sector of 2B compactifications, you should expect that there can generically be a huge number of vacua that are non-degenerate coming from the Kähler sector alone. You don't just need to play this flux game. So the string landscape is actually bigger. Busso-Polchinski told you about the first exponential, but each of these vacua are split into an exponential number of other vacua from the Kähler sector. The complexity of this landscape is the same as in the Busso-Polchinski case. It can, in principle, lead to a consistent cosmology. It's also fun to point out that when you just write down this axion model, first, kinetic alignment tells you that you have a very flat field range, which means that once you tunnel, you're going to inflate via slow roll. And also, precisely this theory has a vacuum structure which is rich enough to accommodate the CC. I don't claim that this theory is what we live in, but it can accommodate the CC and inflation. And this finding really tells you something about the distribution of Suzy breaking in the string landscape. And most likely, we live in a Suzy broken vacuum, which I guess, yeah, looks like it. But this is what also the string landscape would predict. Thank you.
So first, I just want to make sure I understand your point about the last tunneling step. So you're saying that the closest vacuum and field space have a big difference in energy, but there are other vacuum which have a smaller difference.
Mm-hmm.
And also, so given that we know what the CC is, can you have some expectation on what these lambdas are parametrically to get the right scanning?
They can be anything. That's sort of the nice part about it. The microphysics doesn't matter. As long as there are some numbers set in the UV, and I guess you need to make sure that the axions aren't too light. Like if you make these lambdas too light, if you have super light axions, then we might do other fun things with them, but you can compute what, well, the multiple things that are problematic with that. Well, it depends. And I mean, if you have some non-productive effects generated by some UV physics, so let's say these lambdas are at the gut scale,
yeah,
and the decay constants, well, what are they? Maybe like 10 to the 12 GeV. What is that going to give you?
If lambda is at the gut scale, then you will not get those.
Yes, they'll be.
Everything is
yeah, they'll be pretty heavy. And they can stabilize your vacuum very precisely, which can make them disappear from the spectrum. But then of course, you cannot have other, maybe in the spectrum of the theory, there exist other very light axions. But then it might be difficult when you have gravitational instantons that couple two things.
All you need is that you just need some hierarchy between the lambdas, but you don't care where they are.
In order to get this vacuum distribution, you don't need a hierarchy. Yes, you need a hierarchy, a small hierarchy. At least there needs to exist one instanton, which is small compared to the other instantons. Yes, just one, not many.
That's the absolute scale is not important.
No. But yeah, that's interesting.
When I recall
the
physical calculations compared with LHC experiments, I know what the vacuum state is. Gives you results, the line shift to high average. So are you going to say that I have to use the anthropic principle to know what my vacuum state is?
I'm not sure I understand. I certainly don't know the answer. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, we know what the vacuum state is. You have 10 to 500 of them. So why do we know what that vacuum state is that gives the wrong answer?
What decouples from gravity?
Gravity, we don't use gravity to LHC calculations.
Yes, yeah, that's, yeah. Maybe we can talk over lunch.
Hmm?
Maybe we can talk over lunch. Maybe I'll understand.
So I guess there is no test of this theory.
Well, there are predictions.
What is the prediction?
Well, for example, the scale of Suzy breaking.
What is it?
Well, I don't know precisely. I haven't, but I'm predicting that we're living in a non-Suzy vacuum. So first data point is. But I didn't put it in anywhere. I mean, the string landscape. You could reasonably argue. I mean, everything that we found so far is like Suzy. So like the hell, like. You keep telling me this is string landscape that describes this, but you always only find Suzy vacuum. But I'm saying in the Suzy theory, there exist tons of states in which Suzy is broken.
But that's not new, is it?
Well, I haven't.
I think you're not the first person who's broken supersymmetry.
But I've found many vacuum which break supersymmetry.
You can't make
a more bold statement than most people.
Okay, so in what sense is it?
So most people have just said, yes, okay, we can construct this very small number of things, and I claim to have at least some reasonable degree of control over this. But what could there be more generally? I don't know. Mm-hmm. And generally, people have not been willing to make any kind of broad statements.
And your broader statement, I guess I kind of missed that.
It's exponentially unlikely to live in a Suzy vacuum. Exponentially,
okay.
Exponential in the number, in
right.
H11 on your manifold.
Maybe
Yeah.
We kept that argument.
I was a little fast
on
that. Okay, so in your supergravity theory, you have some Kähler potential. It doesn't really matter too much. But you have a non-perturbative superpotential. You have all of these terms. You have the subleading terms and the leading terms. This gives rise to a potential exactly of this kind of form. But the idea is that, let's say you have the one Suzy vacuum of your theory, which is stable, at which each of these terms has vanishing F terms. And now you go from this term to theta goes to theta plus something, at which only the leading potential is invariant under this shift, which means that you still stabilize precisely at that value. Like the potential is exactly the same. You have one Suzy vacuum, and then you only change your potential by a vastly subleading contribution, by a subleading instanton. It's way smaller, so you don't change anything of your masses, nothing really, but you introduce a small F term coming from the fact that one of those terms is not actually at its minimum. It's sitting somewhere on the hill, but because it doesn't have enough energy to actually roll down that hill, you just stabilize it there. So you have a state in your theory at which you have spontaneous F-term Suzy breaking, but the breaking is very small compared to where you stabilized your vacuum.
I mean, to make that sense, it seems to me you have to say, and I think my model is representative of all the string theory landscape that exists.
You
could make a narrower statement.
In this theory,
yes.
It's exponential unlikely. And then that's why I'm comparing to the one model that don't exist that many compactification with a large number of Kähler moduli, but there exists one.
Well,
That one we looked at.
That you know of, right?
That I know of. But yeah. Do you have more?
I haven't any clue.
Okay. Yes. Yes. They exist one in which we have all the data. We look at that one. And there I'm not saying that in the string, I don't know anything about the string landscape.
Okay, you made a slightly bolder statement than you have, but yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to make that.
Okay.
Just exists a tiny corner of the string landscape. We hope to be able to represent it by these theories. We look at those theories, there I can make that statement. We compare it to a few examples. But it tells you where to look in a string landscape. Look at complicated vacua, and you'll find interesting. That's how we found superplankian field ranges. People looked for a long time at simple string vacua, and it's always a fine tuning. It doesn't really like to be superplankian. You look at the first one, which is complicated, and you find Planckian field range. I don't know what that means, but yeah.
What you're doing is you say out of 10 to the power of 500 vacua, there's one specific vacuum state that gives me the right value for lambda.
Might be way more, maybe 10 to the.
Okay, an infinite number.
Well, not infinite. But
what?
Not infinite.
10 to the 500 is close to infinite.
Well, it depends on how far you count.
So the question is, how do you falsify such a thing? You see what I'm saying? Because you've chosen the answer to fit what you've done. How do you falsify this theory? Apart from the fact you may never see axioms.
Well, you compute, no, the landscape is easily falsifiable. Once you see the wrong kind of curvature, then you know that we haven't come from a tunneling event. Is it? It's always either positive or negative, but then omega k.
I think math was here, but you can't get either event. It just makes it a little more complicated.
Yeah, and you could say, okay, so fine. So maybe it wasn't a common tunneling. Maybe it was a little bump, maybe some brains bumped into each other.
It's a hard.
If we did see, I'd be willing to bet money that somebody the next day would come out with three more models consistent with the landscape that would still allow it.
It's hard to falsify, but each particular model does give predictions, and those predictions you can go out and. Well, for example, an empty universe would be the prediction of the first model that it doesn't work.
And you're predicting the existence of dozens of new scalar particles.
Is that a prediction? I'm studying a theory. Then I compute an expectation value in the low energy theory, and that is a prediction.
Right.
And then you can go out there and check whether
the existence of all these axioms, is that a prediction?
I don't know if that's a prediction.
But they're very massive, so I guess.
But the
they
mass
can
is
be
still,
very massive.
There's still this one parameter. There's this lambda.
Yeah, in this theory, if you say, yeah, if you say, I get the CC from the landscape, and I want to do it with axions, then you predict a large number of axions. And then you can study the spectrum of masses of axions. And I haven't done that, but it might be that there exist very low mass axions with large decay constants. And then you can go out. And once you find those, then, but I guess it's not falsifying it, because. Okay, I guess if the theory really predicts something, which I haven't computed what it predicts about low, so yeah, that'd be interesting. And then you go, and maybe it's already ruled out, but I doubt it because you always pick lambda to be high enough.
It's probably not quite.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
So